has now come out as the possible source of the Times Pentagon documents. It is that of Daniel Ellsberg, the top policy analyst for the Defense and State Department.
I am prepared to answer to all the consequences of these decisions.
Henry Kissinger said that Daniel Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America, and he had to be stopped.
The study was 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. It would take me months of Xeroxing.
We've dropped another 200,000 tons of bombs on Indochina. That's 10 Hiroshimas, one Hiroshima a week.
What has remained significant about the release of the Pentagon Papers is the decision by a public official to give priority to conscience as compared to career.
Conscience as compared to career. Bingo. And as we said last Friday, we are paying tribute to Daniel Ellsberg on an ongoing basis. He's in his final months, according to his doctor. He has pancreatic cancer. And this is an idea we stole from Bob Dylan, who paid tribute to Warren Zevon by playing at least one Warren Zevon song for every single concert during the last few months of Warren Zevon's life while Dylan was on tour. Why wait until after the person has passed?
No time to celebrate the accomplishments of a man or woman then while they're still alive and are able to recognize that you're recognizing them.
So we'll be looking for ways to do that here and there as we do our episodes every Tuesday. This is the lightning round, when Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. And then on Friday nights, the more loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. We're on for a couple of hours, and Scott is very much more expansive on Friday nights, when we sometimes even enjoy adult beverages. Speaking of which, we are launching the American Drink Tank, and we're not encouraging people to drink, but this is for people who already drink. We say, hey, while you're unwinding, while you're relaxing, why not pay attention to some of our most pressing societal problems? So this is a kind of a movement, kind of a way to promote some of our events, and we are really doing our best to expand what exists of the peace movement. You know, instead of just kumbaya, we're going to do an event in a church and this and that. We're trying to attract people who otherwise wouldn't attend an anti-war event. And we have some great allies in Texas who are on board with us, who have lined up three venues where adult beverages are allowed. It's not the whole thing. It's just, you know, the idea to create a fun atmosphere so that we can be serious, but also relax a little bit and enjoy ourselves at the same time. So look to our Substack for more details as far as the venues and start times. In the coming days, we'll give you all the specifics and a way to reserve your spot at those events. Thank you very much to our allies in Texas, who did a lot of legwork, a lot of scouting to line up those venues. And we look forward to hanging out with them when we get there later this month. Also, by popular demand, it is now possible to get an autographed copy of our favorite weapons inspector's new book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika. Go to scottrittermerch.com. We're also linking to it from our Substack. People have been clamoring for it, Scott, and now it's actually possible to do it. And by the way, this is not like Scott doesn't just like sign his name and have a stack of books there. These are personalized, individualized autographs. And Scott himself walks to the post office in snow, sleet, or hail to mail it. I mean, how many authors will do that for you? That's what's behind this whole venture. Amazing. And Scott has a new article out now, Enemy of the State. He's referring to himself. You're the number one enemy. What's that all about, Scott?
No, my good friends at the Center for Countering Disinformation in Kyiv, Ukraine, they work directly for Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, have honored me by making me the number one enemy of the state. They've released a list of several notable individuals, and I'm number one.
Well, congratulations.
Yes. And So what I've done, and this comes at the same time that some headlines have been made, an NBC reporter who had the audacity to, carry out journalism, traveled to Crimea and actually interviewed people on the ground in Crimea to trying to find out what the ground truth is. And for this, he's been sentenced to die by the Ukrainian government. They put him on the Miratvorets hit list, the crime journalism. And he was joined by Jackson Inkle. He's a very popular YouTube person. He has a program called The Dive. I'll actually be on The Dive tonight at 9 o'clock. But Jackson has now been condemned to die by the Ukrainian government, who put him on the Miratvorets list. His crime, simply speaking, truth about Ukraine. And so they've joined me. I've been on this list since June. So I decided that I would address this topic. On February 23, the Center for Countering Disinformation put out their, their honors list. And again, I'm number one. I'm proud of this. And they listed my sins. I have five in particular. They've listed six deadly sins that nobody's allowed to do, different thematics that apparently promote a pro-Russian narrative. And I was found guilty of five, but I admit my guilt in the sixth one, and I explain why. So I list the different themes and what the Ukrainian government says. And then rather than putting down what I've said, because all I'm guilty of is telling the truth. And when I say the truth, it's not just analysis. It's literally using the words of Ukrainian officials or U.S. government officials. So what I've done with each thematic that they put out is to show how the Ukrainians are basically condemned by their own language, by the language of their own officials, by the actions of their own officials, by the words of American officials and others, so that everything they say is a crime they're actually guilty of, because they condemn themselves with their own history of rhetoric. The problem is, you can't run away from the truth. And if the truth makes you an enemy of the state, so be it. As I point out, back in the lead up to the Iraq war, Sandy Berger called me one of the more dangerous men in America. I was a threat to national security because I dare speak out about Iraq. And Nicholas Burns, who at the time was the U.S. ambassador to NATO, today he's the U.S. ambassador to China, called me a known enemy of the state, condemning NATO for daring to bring me in to speak about weapons of mass destruction. If that's what you need to do to qualify as an enemy of the state, count me in. I'm there.
All right. So your defense is, I did it, but it's not a crime. All right. Let's go to the questions from our beloved audience. As I said earlier, Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less, or he gets the whip and it hurts. So that usually keeps him in line. We'll see if he complies with that very strict requirement today. And if you would like to submit your questions in advance, you can do that at scottritterextra.com. Just click on Ask the Inspector when you get there. You can also find a link to our Facebook page there, and also a link to a way to buy the book or go directly.
Do we have an asterisk question?
Yeah, we do. Are you ready to address it? Okay. I didn't know whether I was going to protect you in case you didn't get to it, but no need. I got your back, Inspector. I've got your back, but you don't need me to have your back, is what you're saying. All right. So this is a question that Scott was unable to answer previously. And let's start with that. From Samir Husseini in Moscow, what is your opinion of the new Russian military base agreement in Sudan, and how does it affect the Arabian Peninsula, especially in view of the emerging Russia-Iran strategic relationship? What does this mean for Saudi Arabia?
Well, the base agreement they're talking about is a naval base that'll be on the Red Sea, or not on the Red Sea. Let's see, Sudan, maybe the Red Sea. I think it's the Red Sea. I got to look at the map.
Well, that water is all the same.
Water. I think it is the Red Sea. So they've been negotiating this for some time now. The United States has been vehemently opposed. In fact, in the summer of 2022, the United States put a lot of pressure on the Sudanese government, not to engage in these discussions, but, the Sudanese government has cleared it. They say this is a good thing. So Russia will put a base. It's a fairly limited base as far as bases go. It'll basically give the Russians the ability to port or you know, assign to this base three moderate-sized vessels and up to 300 Marines or personnel. This will give them, you know, limited power projection, primarily anti-piracy type presence. But what it does is it means the Russians can now have a more effective means of operation as opposed to having to bring their ships in long distance with logistical ships with them for sustainability, thereby limiting the presence. They'll now be able to have up to three warships able to operate from this base. What does it mean? It's pretty much a symbolic presence, because in and of itself, it's not a meaningful military presence, but it's there, and it's a step in the direction of, you know, enlarging a Russian presence in the region. And when you look at that in the context of improving Russian-Iranian relations, Russia's already expansive relations in Africa, you know, it's something that the Saudis cannot ignore. Again, remember, Saudi Arabia is talking about joining BRICS. So it's not like this is going to be a military presence that's designed to be anti-Saudi. It actually could become part of a larger, you know, effort to build a anti-American coalition, because the Saudis are drifting away from the United States in terms of their oil policy, et cetera.
All right. So we're flashing how to ask questions in advance. Also, we will take some live questions towards the latter part of the podcast, coming in on Facebook and YouTube Live. Let's move to our next question. A Ritter connoisseur from Orange County. That's Southern California. Why did the Trump administration pull out of the INF treaty? They claimed Russia was going against it, developing their own capabilities that violated the treaty. Did the Trump administration have any solid grounds for this claim?
The Trump administration pulled out of the INF treaty because they accused Russia of cheating. They accused Russia of developing a new missile system that had... basically been fired from a ground-based testing facility, and that's prohibited by the treaty. And the other thing they said is that the treaty had outlived its usefulness, that given China's expansive intermediate-range missile force, that the United States was prevented from developing weapons able to counter the Chinese systems by this treaty. And that was the real reason. Russia wasn't cheating. We know this to be absolutely certain. This goes back to intelligence information that was collected by the Obama administration. I've taken a look at what's been made publicly available, and knowing what I know about how things are collected and how things are analyzed, I can pretty much say that the Obama administration was monitoring a system that became the Caliber system, the one that we see being used in Ukraine today, launched from ships, launched from aircraft, which are permitted, not launched from the ground, which is prohibited. They were monitoring that, and they misinterpreted the data. You had a design bureau that was carrying out the Caliber tests and tests of this new system. The United States confused the two, interpreted a Caliber test to be this new system. The Russians actually provided this missile. They did a display in a Moscow where they put this missile out side by side with another missile, the cruise missile variant of the Iskander missile, showing, demonstrating without any shadow of doubt that it was the same booster. That's important because the booster tells you how far it's going to fly. The same booster with a bigger guidance program in a bigger warhead. Now, anybody who knows anything about ballistic missiles will know that if you take a booster and you add weight to it, it will fly less range than the other. So if the other one was a permitted system underneath the 500 kilometer range of the INF treaty, then this new system, which has the same booster, bigger guidance, bigger warhead, would fly less. This is the fact. The Russians weren't breaking the treaty, and I believe the Trump administration knew this, but they were looking for an excuse to get out of the treaty so that they could deploy systems against China. Now, of course, we're deploying these systems in Europe, and we're repeating the same cycle that took place back in the 1980s. Very dangerous escalation, real risk of confrontation between the United States and Russia.
The next question is from Mike C. in Boston. With NATO announcing that any future independent Ukraine will be admitted to NATO, how will Russia not either take a scorched earth policy on the Ukrainian leftovers or commit more troops and fully take Ukraine in its entirety?
The NATO announcement isn't worth the paper it was written on or the hot air that exuded from the mouths of those who made such statements. Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. That's just the bottom fact. And Russia knows this. NATO knows this. Ukraine knows this. Everybody knows this. That was a politically motivated statement. But, you know, they caveated it would be a long time in the future, like never. So Russia is not going to make dramatic alterations to its current posture based upon a statement that has no meaning, no value.
All right. That's a succinct answer. And we will move on to our next question. From Rick McCarty, British Columbia, Canada. Please tell me why Syria and Russia allow the U.S. to steal Syria's oil. Why can't they be kicked out?
Because neither Syria nor Russia want a direct confrontation with the United States, and that's what would be required. You know, for Syria, the last thing they need is the United States to be bombarding their critical infrastructure with long-range cruise missiles and air power. The last thing Russia wants is to take a militarily inferior position posture in Syria and expose it to piecemeal destruction by a superior American force in the Middle East. Because not only would the Russians be defeated in Syria, this would lead to a force-on-force confrontation between Russia and the United States, which eventually will lead to a nuclear conflict. So for the time being, the Syrians and the Russians will do what they always do, be patient, put pressure, and eventually the United States will be forced to withdraw from Syria, as we withdraw from everywhere when our presence is illegitimate, ill-advised, and has no viable future.
All right. Well, it wouldn't be an episode of Ask the Inspector if we didn't have a voicemail message from our friend Filippo in Switzerland, who I swear is auditioning for the non-existent role of co-host of our show, but maybe we'll create a role.
The Lugano co-host.
In essence, we already have him as a co-host. All right, let's hear the latest from Filippo.
Hello, Scott and Jeff. Here is your friend Filippo. U.S. sanction on Chinese import of semiconductors. The arrest of Huawei executive, the AUKUS deal, Pelosi's Taiwan visit, the promotion of the Maidan coup, the bipartisan support of the Ukraine war, the NATO expansion to East, the attack to the Nord Stream, the sanction against Russia. We can't catalog all that under stupidity. I can see a pattern here. Biden, Blinken, Nuland, Burns, Austin. We can argue that US officials very often are superficial. Probably they underestimate Russian and Chinese counterparts, and they are corrupt, but they are not stupid, and they are very well aware of the effects of their provocation in Ukraine and Taiwan. The blob is doing all that not by mistake, but on purpose. Ukraine is not the problem, but the effect of an extremely aggressive bipartisan U.S. foreign policy. Thanks for your comments. Ciao.
Would you say Filippo was pontificating? Would that be the word? Or expounding? Or opining?
Those are American words. Felipe is a Swiss citizen from Lugano, so we'd have to come up with the appropriate Italian, French, German blend. But look, I know what he's saying. Look, Felipe, what's going on here, it's called the rules-based international order. That's the system that defines America's interaction with the world since the end of the Second World War. It's the framework around which we are able to project American hegemony, American dominance, and it's collapsing. So you're right. I mean, you know, these people aren't stupid. They're desperate. And what we have right now is a world where the American singularity, the unilateralism of the United States that's been promoted since the end of the Second World War, is clashing with a multipolarity reality that's backed by Russia, China, India, and other, you know, advanced or developing economies. And so, you know, this is a struggle that the United States will not win and is not winning. But these people aren't smart enough to manage the decline in a way that keeps the United States, you know, relevant, or I would even say more relevant than others. Instead, they're going to fight for a position they no longer have the ability to hold, and in the process, bring themselves down further and maybe others down with them. Like you said, it's not stupidity, but it is an act of desperation, and that's what we're seeing, desperate policy.
All right. We're on the same page with our friend Filippo. Lyndon from the United Kingdom, did you ever meet with Dr. David Kelly, and do you have an opinion on his sad and tragic death?
I had the honor and privilege of knowing David Kelly. I knew him professionally and I knew him personally. I worked with him in New York, where we socialized often. I was able to visit him in England, where we collaborated on issues pertaining to weapons of mass destruction, and I had the privilege of working with him in Iraq in an inspection capacity. I hold him in the highest regard as a professional and as a person. And because I am friends with him, I have made it a policy that I will never discuss his death or the circumstances around it. So we're just going to leave it at that.
All right. We will respect that. Eliza from Romania, what do you think about the new military base in the Danube Delta? In our media, they say Putin is furious and there may be an escalation in Romania.
Another military base. This one I'm actually familiar with vaguely. You say that Putin is furious, but the bottom line is, if it's on Romanian soil, then Putin can't be furious. The Russians can express their dismay. I mean, Russia has made it clear that, you know, that they don't want NATO infrastructure to be on territory that did not belong to NATO prior to 1997, and this Danube base would represent such a you know, expansion of NATO infrastructure. But it's a base on the Danube. It's not going to change the world. It's not like Romania just acquired nuclear weapons, or Romania, you know, suddenly learned how to operate, you know, armored divisions effectively. Romania is Romania. Their military is still the Romanian military, which means they're not very good. And Romania's ability to project naval power is limited, and NATO's ability to operate out of a Danube base in a conflict with Russia would be nil, because that base would be shut down. So this is more about, this is what NATO does right now, which is hold hands and try to make people feel good. But at the end of the day, it's nothing. It doesn't advance NATO's strategic posture in any meaningful fashion.
All right. They say he's furious, but is he having a meltdown? You ever notice how they're always reporting this person or that person is having a meltdown, and then there's never any evidence of the meltdown?
Ask me a question about a certain individual and watch a meltdown. No, okay, don't.
I won't say the meltdown. All right. The Brewmaster, an old friend of ours from Wisconsin. Are you aware of German politician Sarah Wagenknecht's effort to end the conflict in Ukraine? She gave a speech calling for an end to the escalation of the war and to instead negotiate with the Russians. There's also an online petition that she co-sponsored called Manifest for Peace, which has over 700,000 signatures. For that, she is being kicked out of her party, and this may be the end of her political career. Comments?
I'm very familiar with Sarah Wagenknecht's efforts. I applaud them. She's I guess the politically correct term would be heroine, the female version of hero. Yeah. The bottom line, she's a woman of courage, a woman of principle, a woman who's taken a leadership role in bringing to an end an unjust war in Germany's ill-advised cooperation with Ukraine. You know, she's going to go through some tough times. Most great people, when they're on journeys like this, do go through tough times, and there's no doubt that she's going through it now. But I'm also convinced that there's an awakening in Germany, and if her political party follows through, that she will find political relevance elsewhere, and she will have the backing of people, and she will not only remain a member of parliament, but she will have a leadership role in Germany going forward. She is the kind of leader that Germany needs, a woman of principle, a woman of integrity, and a woman of peace. And I wish her the very best, and I know she's going to end up on her feet. She's going through a tough time now, but like I said, anytime somebody stands up against the system comes down hard on them. But I think she has a spine of steel, and she'll do okay.
But is she an enemy of the state, and is she on that list?
She's not on the Ukrainian list yet that I know of.
Everybody who's anybody is on that list.
Well, she has to work. I mean, she should talk to the person that's at the top of the list. I put a good word in for her.
Okay. Kevin Nicolizzi handling backstage duties, which include the curation of live comments coming in, which we'll get to shortly. Yes, curation. I like that word. Yeah, that's what it is. He's curating these questions. Daniel from Austria. Colonel Douglas MacGregor said in an interview, the only way for Russia to win this war is moving on Kiev in a pincer movement from north and south and to take it. You said it will be over once Odessa is freed. Could you elaborate?
Well, talk about me first. What I said is that Vladimir Putin hinted back in the summer of 2022 that Odessa could be the key to either the end of the war or peace. So that's why I said about Odessa. It's not like I woke up one morning and had a, road to Damascus moment where a bright flash appeared and they said, Scott, when Odessa falls, the war will be over. I'm riffing off of what the president of Russia said. Now, he said it in July. A lot has happened since then, to include the mobilization of 300,000 troops, a decisive defeat of Ukraine unfolding in Bakhmut, and a hardening of positions in the West regarding a negotiated settlement. The whole concept of the Odessa moment that I articulated was to create a window of opportunity for negotiation. But if the West is taking negotiations off the table, there's no need for Russia to open up a window. So the Odessa moment may not be today in, say, March of 2023, what it appeared to be back in the summer of 2022. This is what happens when events unfold and you get new facts, etc. So don't compare and contrast what I was saying about Odessa with anything that Colonel MacGregor says. These are two totally different conversations. They're not competing narratives. What Colonel MacGregor is talking about is a military solution, meaning that if you need to resolve the issue of a defiant Kiev, held by a government in opposition, that you would need to capture it. Now, I'd need to know more about why he wants a double pincer move and all that stuff. He's a military professional. He knows what he's talking about. And so I respect his opinion. And I have no basis to challenge it because I don't know enough about, what he was talking about. I personally believe that the Russians will be seeking a military victory against the Ukrainian army and a political victory against Kiev, because to turn Kiev into a military problem becomes inordinately complicated, costly in terms of resources and manpower, and destructive to a city that holds cultural value for the Russian nation. So I'm on the surface of it, I'm not a fan of that, but I live in Del Mar, New York. I'm not on the Russian general staff. I don't advise Putin. So my opinion in 75 cent gets you a cup of coffee, which means the 75 cents is worth more than my opinion. But I'm not going to directly deal with Colonel MacGregor's his position, because I don't know enough about why he said what he said. So once I learn more about the why, then I can discuss the reasonableness of it. That hurt, Jeff.
I don't know why you're criticizing Colonel MacGregor so harshly. That just doesn't seem right. Foo from Chicago. Why do you think the Africans are now beginning to kick the French military out and bring in the Russian military to replace them?
Because the French are, I don't know how to put this, assholes. They were colonial masters who have forgotten, it's seemingly forgotten that that they're no longer colonial masters. There has been this policy of, Afrique France, meaning that even though they're not there, France will continue to exert an influence on Africa. And there's this arrogance that comes with that. And we saw it play out. I mean, one of the more amazing videos, I talk often about the Love Actually, this movie with Hugh Grant, where he played this British prime minister who grew a set of cojones when the American president was there and spoke out about him in a press conference. And everybody's like, oh, that's Hollywood. It would never happen. Ladies and gentlemen, it just happened in Africa. Macron went to Africa and was at a press conference with an African leader. And Macron tried to throw a horse shit move at him, saying, don't talk to me about what a French reporter said. The guy said, it wasn't a French reporter, Mr. President. It was your foreign minister. It was the policy of France. And we're Africa, and we're not putting up anymore. It was a Love Actually moment that happened in real life. And Macron was humiliated. And it was wonderful, wonderful. And France Afrique is rising up and saying, get the hell out of here, France. We don't want to deal with you anymore. We're on our own. And you know why they're embracing Russia? Because Russia doesn't have a history of colonial abuse in Africa. The Soviet Union was there helping the people's movements, the people rising up against colonialism. They were there to help, no strings attached. They were just there helping. And now Russia's there doing the same thing. And I think the Africans sort of like that approach where people come in and say, hey, we're friends. Can we help you? What can we do? Sure, there's going to be some economic contracts and all that stuff, but it ain't colonial domination. It's not the white man coming in and ruling over the black man. This is about human beings working together in a partnership. And that's why Africa's gravitating towards Russia and away from France.
Speaking of the white man coming into another land, here we have Merrick Garland in Ukraine. Since when is the attorney general a diplomat? I thought the attorney general was in charge of crimes, either perpetrating them or prosecuting them, one of the two, or maybe both.
Hopefully he's prosecuting the corruption that's ongoing in Ukraine, led by that man, Zelensky. That'd be nice. Maybe arrest him, Eric. Read him his rights.
Does it look to you like his intent is to prosecute him? I don't know.
Who knows?
All right. Let's go to our next question from Foo in Chicago. Oh, we did? Then let's not go to it. How about that for an idea? Bradford in Mount Kisco, New York. The BBC says the head of Wagner Group is saying he has been set up and that Russia is not sending him the ammunition they promised for February 22nd. And that's why he's taking a lot of casualties and, I presume, not making progress. Is Russia messing themselves up?
Well, let's start with your presumption, not making progress. Again, I'm long distance, just like you are, held hostage to the limitations of the data that's available. But there's nothing coming out of Bakhmut that indicates Wagner's not making progress. They're actually making significant progress, both in terms of their gradual territorial advance, but also in the slaughtering of Ukrainian soldiers. And I say that with no glee in my heart, but that's literally what's happening right now. So let's stop about the presumptions. Here's the deal. Wagner was a private military corporation that was operating in Lugansk and Donetsk, which were not part of Russia. They were actually autonomous areas of Ukraine. And so Wagner had a unique relationship with the Russian government, with the Russian general staff gave a priority of support to Wagner when they were supporting this non-Russian entity. Russian laws do not permit private military contractors. Just don't. And so when Donetsk and Lugansk became part of Russia, Wagner had to go through the difficult transition away from a private military contractor with unique support priorities to being a volunteer unit within the Russian military structure. Welcome to the army. And what happens in that is that you lost that priority. Now your priority is no longer dictated by the unique nature of your organization, but rather by the fact that you are now one of many who are receiving support from the Russian military establishment, which means that you don't get to call the shots anymore. You're not the only show in town. You are one of many, and the Russian general staff is determining where priorities go, because there are other priorities, competing priorities. Bakhmut is not the only fight in town. It is the major fight perhaps going on right now, but there's others. And Bakhmut doesn't happen in a Wagner-only vacuum. There are paratroopers, there are Marines, there are artillery units, there are armor units, there's motorized rifle units. They're all operating in support of Wagner. And Wagner better wake the F up. Now, ask yourself, why is Prigozhin doing this? One, he could be a concerned man about his unit wanting more ammunition, etc. But he's a big boy. He's been doing this a long time. So I think there's another game being played here because Prigozhin's not suicidal. And frankly speaking, what Prigozhin's doing right now is the quickest way, if it was real, to get a bullet in the back of his head, because the Russians aren't going to put up with this nonsense for too much longer. So I think Prigozhin is playing a game, and we saw him play a game. Remember that guy got the sledgehammer to the head? Turned out it was fake. Why? He was an intelligence guy doing an intelligence game, trying to collect information, etc. I bet that what Prigozhin's involved in right now is a big piece of set piece drama designed to confuse the living crap out of the Ukrainians, Americans, and you, the audience, to make you think there's trouble when there is no trouble. That's what I think is going on, because otherwise Prigozhin deserves to be taken out, have a bullet put in his head, because he's disrupting the Russian war effort.
All right, let's take one more question of the ones that were submitted in advance, and then we'll go to the live questions to see if Kevin Michalitzi's handiwork deserves to be characterized as curation. Have I put the pressure on you, Kevin? Well, you can handle it. Pick some great questions. And this is coming in live on Facebook and YouTube. We also stream live to Twitter, Twitch, and Rumble, but we cannot insert those questions live, unfortunately. All right, the last of the pre-submitted questions. Daniel from Amsterdam, why is Bakhmut so important for Ukraine, or is it also important for Russia? Is it some kind of military or logistical hub, or is it politics?
I think it's a combination of both. I think, remember, when you talk about the Soledar-Bakhmut complex, you're talking about these salt mines that are underneath, and these salt mines provide security, they provide storage capacity, etc. It's also an area that his, you know, is sort of the anchor for this large defense. You know why it's taken Russia so long to get to Bakhmut? Because between Bakhmut and where they started in May are nonstop networks of entrenchments. And all those entrenchments were shielding Bakhmut. So Bakhmut was the hub that supported all of this defense. And so Bakhmut was, in fact, the center of gravity of the Ukrainian defensive belt. Now, one would think that as the Russians reduce the defensive belt, the critical importance of Bakhmut diminishes, because now it only becomes about defending Bakhmut itself. And maybe, rather than sacrificing everything, you should pull back onto more defensible positions and force the Russians to start all over again. But the Ukrainians have committed so much into Bakhmut that this has become political in nature, very similar to what happened with Stalingrad. You know, Stalingrad as a city should have been bypassed by the Germans, and they should have just kept driving. But because it had the name, the Germans put everything into it, and the Russians were able to suck them into a trap and get into this fight. That ended up costing the Germans the 6th Army, parts of the 4th Tank Army. The Italians, the Hungarians, Romanians were all wiped out because of Hitler's focus on this city that became politically important. Bakhmut has become politically important for the Ukrainians. For the Russians, that's where they are, man. That's where they're killing them. I mean, you know, basically the Russians have killed between 70 and 110,000 Ukrainians in Bakhmut. And if you're in the business of killing Ukrainians and the Ukrainians want to come to Bakhmut and die, then that's where you wage the battle. So that's what they're doing. But if the Ukrainians abandoned Bakhmut and the Russians took it, for the Russians, that's just another step in the direction, the overall direction that they have to take to liberate all the territory. Bakhmut doesn't solve the whole problem. You may, if you exploit a Bakhmut victory properly, be able to roll up the defenses and achieve a greater penetration. But who knows? That's predicting outcomes. But this has become a political battle over a space that used to have considerable military importance, but less so now that the rest of the defenses have been reduced.
All right, let's go to Kevin Michalitzi and the curated questions coming in live on Facebook and YouTube. Maria Elena Leva has a question. Will Maverick be in Texas?
I'd love to bring Maverick in Texas, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen. Maverick is a very, very ill-disciplined dog. And my biggest concern is he would get out and run. And while he generally tends to come back, there's a lot of cars out there. And I'm just not going to, I mean, it's scary. Every time I open the door here, I have to control this dog. And I'm not going to put him in a situation where he can get hurt. I love the dog too much. And so Maverick will be in Texas and spirit only.
You ever tried to train Maverick?
Maverick trains me.
It's not even in the car. It's just, I should just.
Have you ever dealt with a Pomeranian before in your life?
Not in this particular lifetime, no.
All right. So once you learn about the Pomeranian breed, you'll realize that they're very smart, but I've never had success in training a Pomeranian. They train me. So.
All right. If you say so. Eric Suarez, thank you for the donation, Eric. Much appreciated. Scott, can the United States make a legal case to intervene in Mexico now that American citizens were kidnapped and killed?
Probably not. It's all about proportionality. I mean, this is a bad thing that happened. The United States should be. I wasn't aware that they were killed. I knew they had been kidnapped. I didn't realize they had been killed.
Two of them, I think, were killed, and two of them are alive, is the last I saw.
Okay. Were they saved, the two that are alive? Was there a raid or something?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure. I only saw the headline.
I mean, every day in part of the world, Americans are dying, and a lot of times those Americans are murdered. That's not a casus belli. That's not an act of war. It's a crime. And so, you know, we're not going to go to war against Mexico because, you know, some drug cartel kidnapped some Americans. I think they were wrongly identified and ended up killing some. We're not going to go to war about that. This is a law enforcement issue. This is, this is where the United States diplomats earn their money. They need to go in and put pressure on the Mexican government to try to prevent this sort of thing from happening. And if the Mexican government can't, then the United States has to, you know, warn its citizens away from traveling to Mexico until Mexico can make it safe for Americans to be there. But no, it's not an act of war.
Now, you answered as if the word intervene implies something very specific, and maybe it does, but I would have thought, well, it depends on the manner in which they would intervene. Does it mean something very specific when he talks about the U.S. intervening?
I was just reading that into, intervening militarily or something of that nature. I mean, will there be a diplomatic intervention? Yeah. I hope.
Right. Well, I mean, coming in to save somebody would be considered a military intervention.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Mexico's a sovereign state. Really, every time a Mexican citizen gets caught up in a bad thing here, what, the Mexicans have permission to bring their commandos into America and resolve the issue? No.
Right. When you put it that way. All right. Cappy McCappy. Of the famous McCappy family. Thanks for the donation. What happens if Zelensky is assassinated? Well, he dies.
Depends who does it and, for what reason and what happens after that. Assassination is the most terminal way of ending the Zelensky government or the Zelensky regime. If it's done, in a punitive fashion that he's basically angered a certain faction. So they kill him, but they don't plan on who's going to replace him. It could lead to chaos. It could lead to somebody worse than Zelensky becoming president. If it's done by the military as part of a concerted effort to remove a corrupt government from power and put in place a government that will better be able to negotiate an end to the conflict with Russia, maybe it's a positive thing. The bottom line, though, is I personally believe that Zelensky is heading in the direction of being violently removed from power. He's no longer seen as the Winston Churchill of Ukraine. The West is slowly pushing him away. He's an embarrassment. He's destructive to his own country. He's done nothing good. And I don't believe anybody views him as being the solution to Ukraine's future. So, Zelensky, if you're listening, take your wife, your kids, get on an airplane, get the hell out of Ukraine. You'll be alive. You have a lot of money out there. You'll be able to live quite well. You'll get a book tour. You'll get a movie. You'll get to hang out on the beach. You're still a young guy. Got a lot of years left. You'll learn how to play golf. It'll be really cool. Maybe you can even start a new career as a comedian. But
maybe if you can share a summer home with Merrick Garland.
He could.
Yeah, Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard. Yeah,
he's going to die if he stays in Ukraine.
The Angel in Quebec with another donation. Thank you so much, Richie. Was sure the pivot to Iran went up the priority list, but looks like they are really that insane, and the rhetoric is moving to China. What are your thoughts, Scott?
I mean, the rhetoric's there, but is the substance. I mean, there's a lot to be concerned about. The United States making the decision to put between 200 and 300 U.S. troops in Taiwan as trainers. Kevin McCarthy talking about making a visit, openly hostile rhetoric coming from American generals. But then there's the reality, which is the United States isn't in a position to wage war against China. We know it. I mean, I think you were learning the lessons from Korea or from Ukraine. Right now, there's not a single American officer of note that says, yeah, we got this. We could fight Russia. In fact, General Cavoli, the lieutenant general who's in command of U.S. forces in Europe, says, we can't do it. We're not ready. We never imagined a war like this. We're not organized, trained, equipped, prepared to do that. And if we can't do that in Ukraine, we can't do that against China. So I think this is a reality check. And what happens when the military issues a statement of, that says we can't do it, the politicians, rather than saying, we acknowledge that, okay, everybody, let's look weak, because that's what we are. The politicians say, okay, we're really weak. Let's look strong. Start talking big, start talking tough, looking tougher than we are to create a presence. It's about perception management. And what mitigates this is that Taiwan is increasingly becoming cognizant of the fact that America is just a lost cause. We're not friendly. We're not allies. We blow up pipelines. We do a whole bunch of stuff. You see the Kuomintang party, which is the opposition to the current party that's in place, starting to make moves as if they're going to win the 2024 election. They've already reached out to China to try and, temper the tensions. And I think that's the future. And so, the U.S. is talking big, but we don't have anything to back it up. And Taiwan is starting to, an opposition's developing in Taiwan that may very well be the political future of Taiwan.
All right. Continuing with the curation. Take a pause if you need it, Kevin. Scott, what do you think about the article in the New York Times that implicitly admitted, in all caps, the U.S. involvement in NSS, but suggesting that it was done by the pro-Ukrainian terrorists?
Well, what's curious is if you take out the part about the divers being Russian and Ukrainian divers who magically learned how to dive in the Baltic and had support. It's Seymour Hersh's story. It's what Cy Hersh said. You have these divers come in, put explosives on the pipeline, and blow it up. But now the U.S. has conducted its own investigation, and it's saying, well, there were divers, and they went down there, and they put high explosive on there. But it wasn't us. It was the Ukrainians. It was some Russian elements too. It wasn't Putin though. Putin didn't do this. This was other Russians who did it. And they had specialist training. The kind that Cy Hersh talked about coming out of Panama City, Florida. They had specialist training. This is horse manure. This is the U.S. panicked because the facts are out there. Hersh's article is dead on, and so they have to spin a certain facts that are coming out about diver support, high explosive, etc., because all the nations know that divers went there and put high explosive on there. That's what the Danes know, the Swedes know, the Germans know. Everybody knows. They all collected that data. Everybody knows divers went down and put high explosive on there. That was Cy Hersh's story. Now, what the U.S. is doing is say, yeah, that's true, but it was these Ukrainians and these Russians. Hey, how did they get there? Where did they operate out of? How did they get the deep diving support? Where did they get their training? Because you said they were specialist trainers. Really, the Ukrainians have a cadre of divers that go out and do this kind of stuff. You're telling me there's Russian freelancers out there doing this kind of stuff? No, there's the CIA C branch who works with these guys from Panama City that do that kind of stuff. And what they're doing right now is spinning a cover story. That's what's happening here.
Okay. We have time for a couple more live questions coming in on Facebook and YouTube. This is from, that's a font that's difficult to read. Baba, is that a Y?
Baba Yaga Forest Dweller.
Why do some say Scott has a one-track mind that leaves out U.S. naval strength, that he talks of ground war, but never the human belly button? Why do you never talk about the belly button, Scott?
Well, I think she's talking about a different kind of naval. I actually talk about the U.S. Navy often. I say that the U.S. Navy's survivability in the Black Sea is zero. So in any conflict with Russia, where U.S. ships were unfortunate enough to be in the Black Sea, they'd all sink. So that's why I don't talk about them very much, because why talk about things that aren't going to be there very long? And I also talk about the U.S. Navy going up against Taiwan. I repeatedly say that the Navy won't make it to Taiwan because China's long-range hypersonic precision missiles will sink the U.S. fleet before it gets to Taiwan. I've spoken about this often. I've spoken about General Berger's wise decision to go away from legacy amphibious operations that date back to World War II, where the Marine Corps puts all of its resources on a limited number of ships, takes them up to an enemy coast, and then disembarks and goes forward. Because what happens is on their way to their disembarkment point, these ships will be hit by area denial munitions and they'll be sunk and everybody will die. The U.S. Navy is an antiquated concept. They, again, legacy approaches. The carrier battle group dates back to World War II. And it may have viability if you want to float a carrier off the coast of Afghanistan to bomb Afghan wedding parties. It may have viability if you want to float a carrier into the Red Sea and bomb Iraqi villagers. But it has zero viability if you want to put it in the Baltic and try and bomb Russia, because the Russians will sink every single one of those ships. It has zero viability if you want to put it off the coast of Taiwan, because the Chinese will sink every single one of those ships. Naval power projection is antiquated thinking in the day and age of hypersonic missiles.
And the next question is, oh boy, you want to
Stanislav Ketchin.
Say it again.
Stanislav Ketchin.
All right. Shoigu visited Mariupol. He talked about Bakhmut and where the front would move after it was cleaned up. But he himself was not in Bakhmut. Is he afraid of Prigozhina?
Prigozhin.
Prigozhin. How to pronounce it?
Yeah, but that he sort of feminized the last name.
I get it. Okay.
So I don't think Shoigu is afraid of Prigozhin. Shoigu is the Minister of Defense. Shoigu could have Prigozhin arrested right now if he wanted to. And anybody who resisted that arrest would be arrested and killed. I mean, Wagner is a very combat capable unit, and they deserve all the positive remarks that can be made about what they've accomplished in Bakhmut. But they are not a law unto themselves. They are part of the Russian military organization right now, Russian military structure. They report to the general staff and they report to Shoigu. Shoigu is their commander. And Prigozhin knows this. He's smart enough to know this. So I think there's a little game going on right now for intelligence benefit. Shoigu's not afraid. First of all, why would the Minister of Defense go to the most hotly contested battlefield in Russia? Do you imagine the propaganda victory that the Ukrainians would get if they killed Shoigu? So there's no reason for him to go there. He's the Minister of Defense of Russia, all of Russia, which means all of the issues that Russia faces, not just the battle in Bakhmut. I wouldn't read into it too much.
It's a common criticism of people who choose not to do something. People go, oh, you're afraid. Maybe it's the wisest decision sometimes. Subliminal art. How important is Crimea to Mr. Putin?
It's not the right question. Putin's a man. He currently occupies the office of the presidency, but Crimea doesn't belong to Putin. Nothing belongs to Putin. Putin is a Russian president. He works for Russia. He works for the Russian people. So the question is, how important is Crimea to the Russian people? And it means everything to the Russian people. Crimea is Russia. And the Russian people will not allow Crimea to be taken away from them ever again. When Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine during the Soviet times, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. And so the Russians identified as Soviet citizens, so they didn't really lose Ukraine. When Ukraine became an independent entity in 1992, there was a lot of concern about the naval base, but also the Russians. They identified as Russian. Now there's no doubt, since 2014, Crimea has been part of Russia and will forever be part of Russia. And that'll be the case when Vladimir Putin is buried. That'll be the case when Vladimir Putin's successor is buried. That'll be the case in 100 years. That'll be the case in 200 years, 300 years, 400 years, in time immemorial. Crimea is Russia, and all of Russia agrees on that point. So that's the question, is what does Russia feel about it? And I think Russia has spoken. Crimea is Russia and will forever be Russia. What Vladimir Putin thinks is irrelevant because he's a man. Now, if you say Vladimir Putin as the president, if you said, what does the president of Russia think? Then the answer is the president of Russia represents the will of the Russian people, and therefore Crimea is everything to him as well.
Okay, we have time for just a couple of more questions. Michael Lubin asks, could Scott out arm wrestle Putin?
No.
That is the same word in English, French, and Spanish, by the way. Did you know that? No.
No, or arm wrestle.
Weird core space. Is it true that Kadyrov, I guess that's pronounced, is poisoned, like the Daily Mail suggests?
I don't know. I mean, I've read that story. I've seen the rumors, but you know, is it true that Vladimir Putin has cancer, like the Daily Mail suggests?
Doesn't look like
that. What the sources are for the Daily Mail. Ask yourself what the reporting history of the Daily Mail is. Does the Daily Mail have a history of putting out highly suggestive inflammatory titles, headlines that have no relation to reality? And the answer is yes. So I'd be hesitant to buy into any reporting coming out of the Daily Mail.
All right, let's do one more question and then call it an episode. From Ronald, do you ship your book to the Netherlands, Scott, and do you accept PayPal? Well, so far, that's a good question. I'll answer that unless you want to also chime in. So far, it's just U.S. Give us a moment to work on other countries. And I think that's the answer, yeah?
Yeah, let me put it this way. I'm a sucker, and I can't say this on the air because then everybody's going to send it to me. I have mailed books to Europe because I'm that kind of guy. I will tell you right up front, if I mailed it to everybody, I'd go bankrupt. I'm just going to be straight up. Let's say you even buy the book. Okay, so you pay $30 for the book. Then I'm going to pay $48 to mail it to you. And I hope you understand what I'm saying there. Because by doing that, because there's no easy mechanism, so it ends up that
But what we may be able to do is work out a way where they pay the shipping charges if they
want. Right, and that's
a lot of money for them if they really want it.
$80 for a book. Yeah. It's a hell of a book. Yeah. And my signature, you know, probably devalues the book somewhat, but if you wanted my signature, we could do that too. I just wish there was a way that you could get that we could do this cheaper. That's all. I just feel horrible about the, you know, an $80 solution to a $40 problem. But
maybe the solution is a tour, a world tour where we can just sell the books there.
Yeah, the solution would be to get the Dutch to publish it in Dutch, and then I do a book tour, and then we could just sign the books in Holland.
Right. Well, that's how to find the book. You can go directly to the merch website, which is scottrittermerch.com, and if you forget that, just go to our Substack, because we link to a lot of good stuff from our Substack. We just published a brand new article by Scott called Enemy of the State. And also, we want you to know that we'll be in Texas at the end of the month. And we also have a Substack page with the event info. That's scottritterextra.com/uncancelled. That's where you can get the event info. Within the next couple of days, we'll tell you the exact start times and how to reserve your spot at those three events. Thank you, Kevin Michalitzi. Great job. Thank you, Scott. Thank you to our beloved audience. We will see you on Tuesday. No, today is Tuesday. We will see you Friday night for the loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. We also have another podcast that I have the honor of co-hosting with my friend Kevin Michalitzi and my other friend Tori Mansfield. That Sunday is at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can see that in the same channels where we stream this podcast. Thanks, Scott. Take care.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Kevin. And thanks, everybody, for watching.